intended for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. Cover story this week, The Great Divide. While elite schools reel in students, others scramble to fill slots as the pool of potential college students shrinks. Before we get to the cover story, we'll go over the biz section and the reporter pages. The biz section is written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Top story this week concerns the Wolfpack's remarkable run in basketball. T-shirts and beer sell briskly. The stunning postseason run by the men's basketball team at NC State University has local businesses with Wolfpack ties howling with delight and scrambling to keep up. The red and white shop at Ridgewood Shopping Center has sold around 20,000 T-shirts as orders poured in. Speaking of pouring, the players' retreat ran out of cans and bottles of beer as a massive crowd came for the second round of NCAA play. "We ran out of beer. We sold all the canned and bottled beer we had," PR owner Gus Gussler says. "We had only draft beer." Gussler says the bar sold 801 cans and bottles and 519 draft beers that day as 909 guests were there. A week earlier, the Packs' win over the University of North Carolina in the ACC tournament final set a sales record for the 73-year history of the bar. But that second-round NCAA win crushed that mark by 20%. "It's been crazy for us," Gussler says. Mario Cirdella, who owns the Red and White Shop, has scrambled to match demand as orders arrive online and people visit the store. "Every day since we won the ACC tournament has been like a home football game for us," he says. "What's driving this is that State had not won the ACC title since 1987, and this Wolfpack team is an endearing one led by the ebullient DJ Burns." "There are some good storylines associated with this team," Cirdella says. He adds, "This team really believes in itself. That's captured the imagination of our fans." Despite the heavy sales, Cirdella says, "If you come into our store, we're going to have inventory for you." The Wolfpack plays, which should be played now, March 29th at 7:09 p.m. in the round of 16, and the NC State women are in NCAA play the same night at 7:30 p.m. That annoys Gussler, who doesn't understand why the NCAA didn't space those games out. But still, he's preparing for the night and weekend with extra beer on hand. It's going to be great Friday night. And if, in case you hadn't heard, the Wolfpack did win, and so they advanced to the Elite Eight. NIH grants make impact on Triangle. With Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill leading the way, North Carolina is one of the top states in securing funding from the National Institutes of Health. And that funding makes a difference. A recent report from United for Medical Research, made up of research institutions, patients, health advocates, and private industry, says every dollar of NIH research funding generates $2.46 in economic activity. Organizations within North Carolina brought about $2.28 billion in NIH funding to the state last year. UMR says this funding supported about 25,081 jobs and generated about $5.34 billion in economic activity. The vast majority of NIH's $47.7 billion budget is awarded as grant funding to universities, nonprofits, and companies to support research projects. The funding supports employment and purchases of research-related goods and materials, generating income that cycles through the economy and produces new activity, UMR says. Academy Sports grabs former Dick's spot. Dick's Sporting Goods, which Dick Stack started in Binghamton, New York in 1948, has become synonymous with big-box sports shops. But a retailer out of Texas is looking for a bigger slice of the Triangle market. Last year, Dick's Sporting Goods closed its location in Knightdale, but that gap was filled on March 22nd when Academy Sports and Outdoors opened in the 45,000-square-foot space that Dick's previously occupied at 216 Hinton Oaks Boulevard. This is the Texas retailer's second store in Wake County, following the opening of a store in Apex in 2017, and it's the first of 15 to 17 locations that Academy Sports plans to open nationwide this year. Durham data firm now fully part of Truist Bank. Nearly 2 years after Truist announced plans to acquire the assets of a Durham technology firm, it has come to fruition. The Charlotte bank announced in August of 2022 plans to buy assets of Zaloni, a data technology firm founded by entrepreneurs Ben Sharma and Bijoy Bora in 2007. This week, CEO Susan Cook said on LinkedIn, "That's a wrap, Zaloni. From the dream and incredible vision of our founder, Ben Sharma, to serving huge customers like Bank of America and TIAA, and now embedded in the fabric of Truist, what a ride it has been," she continued. "We have fully completed our transition after the strategic acquisition over a year ago. Our software and our employees are happily settled in their new homes within Truist and Infosys. It's time to say goodbye to the Zaloni logo, but the indomitable spirit and culture of this little company will live on forever." Speaking of Truist, they signed plan to purchase land at Topsail Island. "Here at Biz, we're always keeping an eye on the North Carolina coast, and a fascinating move is underway in Topsail Island. The Coastal Land Trust has negotiated a deal to purchase 149 acres of land at South Topsail, known as The Point, for $8 million. The land includes 1.6 miles of coastline. But now comes the tough part, raising the money. The trust says it is looking to raise the money by March 2025. The trust is pursuing federal and state funding, but says private support will be essential. The Point represents one of the last vestiges of undeveloped privately owned land on North Carolina's Barrier Islands, says Harrison Marks, executive director of the Coastal Land Trust. Its protection hinges on community support. Together, we will ensure this ecological haven remains intact for generations to come. And finally in biz, Pinehurst names number 10 Sand Mines course. Pinehurst Resort's newest golf course has an official branding. The new Pinehurst number 10 golf course will be known as Pinehurst Sand Mines. According to the resort, the land where the eighth hole sits was once the site of a mine that shipped sand across North Carolina. The course, designed by Tom Doak, opens April 3rd and will be the venue's first new golf course in roughly three decades. Its opening comes just months before the U.S. Open returns to Pinehurst for the first time in a decade. The tech and aviation section is written by Lauren Onosorge. Her top story this week, Inside Wolf Speed's plant in Chatham County. With the crank of a towering crane, the ceremonial topping of a long-planned semiconductor facility was complete, but there's a way to go before it matches the ambitions of Wolf Speed, a next-generation semiconductor company aggressively trying to meet the demand of the electric vehicle industry. The ceremony, which happened March 26 in front of a tent alongside the under-construction facility, attracted executives and dignitaries from CEO Greg Lowe to Senator Tom Tillis. "We are ushering in a new era for Wolf Speed," Lowe told the crowd. "The facility is massive, planned to be the only purpose-built automated plant for 200-millimeter silicon carbide wafers in existence. Executives use the word revolutionary to describe the facility, which, if all goes as planned, will be ready to scale up in 2025. As of the day of the event, 2,007 workers were milling about the site, where crystal growers have already been installed in advance of the minimal production expected to start by the end of the year. Chief Technology Officer Elif Barkas told TBJ that the first grower could come online in the next quarter or so. The plan is to test it, certify it, and then gradually bring other growers online. "I'm so excited," she said. "It's amazing how a year ago there was nothing here." The project was announced in September of 2022, and within days, clearing started. The first steel beam was placed last June. The project will be constructed in multiple phases, with the first two already envisioned. One person close to the project said the plan is to continue expanding at the site for the next decade. The Phase 1 facility alone, which is already towering over US 1 in Silver City, is 2 million square feet on 445 acres. 225 of those acres are earmarked for the facility that's been swiftly rising on the hillside. In aviation news, Avelo eyes international flights, won't say if RDU is an option. One of Raleigh-Durham International's low-cost budget carriers confirms plans to expand its network internationally. Avelo Airlines has applied for federal approval to offer scheduled international flights, a move that could someday mean more nonstop vacation destinations out of the Triangle. Avelo Airlines, which already operates international charters for a company called Apple Vacations in Michigan, filed for permission to fly to Mexico and the Dominican Republic. Could that mean more international options for RDU travelers? An Avello spokeswoman would only say it has been always been our plan to fly international scheduled service. Our recent filings with the Department of Transportation are a preliminary regulatory step towards potentially initiating service between the U.S. and certain points in the Dominican Republic and Mexico, spokeswoman Courtney Goff says. The airline would not say whether it was considering RDU for international service, but Brett Snyder of Cranky Flyer says it's a possibility. It's hard to know exactly what airports would benefit from this, but RDU is one of Avello's bases and has a customs facility, so it certainly would be an option for the airline, he says. Bank bets big on Raleigh. As it works to close on its buyout of a homegrown coastal North Carolina institution, Providence Bank is doubling down on retail in Raleigh. PB Financial Corp., the holding company for 18-year-old Providence Bank in Rocky Mount, announced last year its plans to buy Coastal Bank and Trust of Jacksonville, creating a bank with $874 million in loans and $893 million in deposits. CEO Ted Whitehurst says the plan is still to close in the second quarter. The banks are working on their integration plan while at the same time making major moves in Raleigh. Whitehurst says the bank recently relocated its office in Raleigh to its own freestanding building. The lobby access and drive-through, which will open in April, will bring increased traffic. And finally, Raleigh is the surge leads NC jobs. That's an awkward headline. Raleigh surge leads NC jobs. A new report out of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia, shows North Carolina's employment is up nearly 7.7% from pre-COVID levels, amounting to nearly 355,000. When you parse out Raleigh, the news is even better, says Laura Ulrich, a senior regional economist with the Fed who covers the Carolinas. The Raleigh Metro accounts for about 81,400 of those jobs, having seen 12.6% growth during that same time period, according to Fed data. Ben Tobin is the writer of the Greater Triangle Growth section. In Johnston County, Clayton approves a project for 335 homes. It took cutting more than 100 housing units and completely eliminating townhomes, but a proposed residential subdivision has finally received approval in Clayton after months of negotiations. The town council voted recently to approve a conditional zoning for roughly 146 acres along Vinson Road, that will pave the way for a residential subdivision consisting of 335 single-family homes. Originally, Hopper Communities of Charlotte proposed for the neighborhood to have a mix of 457 single-family homes and townhomes. Bill Harrell, Raleigh development partner with Hopper Communities, said that all of our hard work planning up to the last minute negotiating with the town and perseverance has finally led to a successful rezoning. After almost a two-year rezoning, we're finally able to move into the next phase of the process with the site plan approval, construction drawings, and permitting, Harrell said. We're very excited to bring this project to the town of Clayton. The townhome component of the project was one of the biggest sources of contention when Hopper Communities presented to the council in January. Council members said they were concerned about the proximity of the development to the surrounding Glen Laurel neighborhood, full of lot sizes of a quarter acre and above. An acre consists of 43,560 square feet, and townhomes for this proposed development would have taken up around 1,500 heated square feet. The new minimum lot size is 6,000 square feet, Harrell said earlier this month. Harrell and his team earned goodwill by removing the townhome component after listening to council members. Addressing the developers during the town council meeting, Clayton Mayor Jody McLeod said, "I can't say enough about your willingness to have continued conversations with us. The biggest win here is for the community because you listened. The community is getting a developer that wants to be a good neighbor," McLeod said. "I can tell you right now, there have been several developers that were not good neighbors and didn't care whether they were good neighbors or not." In Chatham County, a Chatham bed and breakfast fetches millions. A bed and breakfast and events venue near the site of a major economic development project in Chatham County is under new ownership after being auctioned off late last year. The Shady Wagon Farm venue, sold to SRK Events LLC of Cary for $2.38 million, according to a Chatham County deed dated March 15th. Bids were received in November at a live auction. The property is at 259 Shady Wagon Farm Road, located off Pea Ridge Road north of Highway 1 in an unincorporated part of the county near Moncure. The property consists of more than 22 acres of farmland and several commercial buildings, including a six-bedroom, three-bathroom house built 15 years ago, and a wedding and event center with a capacity of up to 200 people. It's unclear why SRK Events bought the property and if the group plans to make any improvements. In Lee County, contractor invests in warehouse. A general contractor in Sanford recently paid more than $1 million for a warehouse in booming Sanford. An LLC tied to Donnie Oldham, the president of Sanford Contractors, purchased a 21,600-square-foot warehouse at 840 White Hill Road this month for roughly $1.4 million, according to Lee County deed records. The building currently houses Mid Pines Hosiery Company, a small sock distributor. We have some internal needs, but plan to lease the majority of the space to others, says Oldham, the buyer of the building. TBJ's real estate section is written by Kaylee Thompson. Her top story this week, University Place adds Chick-fil-A and ice cream. A major development in Chapel Hill is adding big brands to its retail lineup and pushing ahead with more construction. University Place, the transformational redevelopment of University Mall by Ram Realty Advisors, will start work at the end of March on locations for Chick-fil-A, Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams, and Chase Bank. The first residential building, 900 Willow, is about to finish with 253 units. Already, Cycle Bar and Fifth Third Bank have opened. Cycle Bar is the largest indoor cycling franchise in the world, and this is its first Chapel Hill location. When complete, University Place will have 350,000 square feet of open-air retail and restaurant space, 60,000 square feet of office space, and apartments and up to 150 hotel rooms. As malls around the country struggle amid falling valuations and changing dynamics in retail, many property owners and developers are looking to transform shopping centers into mixed-use destinations. The open-air concept of University Place could be a driver in revitalizing the mall. Another local open-air retail center, the Village District in Raleigh, is an example of a high-performing property. The Chick-fil-A at University Place is replacing the former K&W cafeteria and will be a standalone building with a drive-thru. Chase Bank will be in a new building along Estes Drive. It's part of J.P. Morgan's retail expansion plans in the region. Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams will be in a 1,000-square-foot building that will anchor one side of the new 15,000-square-foot community green space named The Commons. It will have live music and hold community events throughout the year, including the Chapel Hill Farmers Market. The team has been very deliberate in selecting the right brands to bring the redevelopment of University Place to life. Jenny's is the perfect addition to The Commons to energize that space year-round, says Jeff Kurtz, Vice President of Development for Ram Realty. Ram Realty also says Wake Med Health will open an urgent care at University Place, and Curry Up Now, an Indian street food concept based in San Francisco, will join the development. 900 Willow will have studios and one- and two-bedroom apartments. Rental rates will range from $1,685 to $2,778, according to Apartments.com. The units will have quartz countertops, stainless steel appliances, and in-unit washer and dryers. Some units will have private patios. Craft Brewery planned near Crabtree. A new craft brewery is in the works at an office park near Crabtree Valley Mall. Highwoods Properties filed site plans for a brewery and restaurant in its Glen Lake office park in Raleigh. It appears as though Crooked Hammock Brewery, a Delaware brewery, will be built. Renderings in the plan say Crooked Hammock Shell Building. Crooked Hammock is part of La Vida Hospitality out of Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, which has stated it has been looking to expand into Raleigh. The one-story building will be 8,152 square feet with 54 parking spaces and surface parking. There will be 0.31 acres of outdoor space, including a covered outdoor area and green spaces. And finally, in North Raleigh, sale of apartments shows market changing. Another Raleigh apartment complex has sold for less than its assessed value. Westport Capital Partners, a real estate investment firm out of Connecticut, recently acquired the Cambridge Apartments for $22.6 million, according to Wake County deed records. The apartments have an assessed value of about $27.5 million as of this year's property revaluations. There are 168 units and 12 three-story buildings, making the price around $134,500 per unit. Cambridge Apartments is on 11.67 acres at 6801 Chester Brook Court off Six Forks Road, north of Lynn Road. Beacon Real Estate Group of Florida sold the complex after acquiring it in 2005 for $10.7 million. Apartment transactions have seen prices fall over the past year amid a slowdown in the overall real estate market and a flood of new multifamily supply being delivered in the region. Zach Ezone writes about healthcare and higher education. AG Biome sells assets to a Maryland company. Months after informing state officials of plans to potentially lay off all employees, a biotech and research Triangle Park has secured a deal to sell its assets. Certis Biologicals of Maryland has acquired multiple assets from AG Biome, including its lead commercial products, two fungicides called Howler and Thea. The company did not disclose financial details. The deal follows AG Biome in October informing the NC Department of Commerce of its plans to potentially lay off all 123 employees from its operations on TW Alexander Drive. The agriculture-focused company, led by co-CEO Scott Uckness and Eric Ward, anticipated these changes would be permanent. AG Biome filed this notice with state officials as it struggled to raise capital in what it described in October as an extremely challenging VC and private equity market. The company had been trying to raise money since early summer 2023, and while many investors showed interest, AG Biome needed a lead investor to set the terms for the financing, Uckness said in October. AG Biome, since 2013, raised more than $200 million from investors, including from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with the latest raise being a $116 million Series D round that closed in 2021. Uckness in October said the company has several external circumstances that occurred that resulted in the need for additional capital. At the time, Uckness said AG Biome was involved in several active discussions and was optimistic about its financing options. But amid a difficult financial environment, AG Biome said it filed its notice with the state to give employees an opportunity to find new work. The layoffs, according to the notice, were expected to become effective on December 15th. In mid-December, Uckness confirmed that AG Biome was involved in confidential discussions related to the company's future. An AG Biome spokesperson said then that this process would extend past the December 15th effective date included in the company's layoff notice to the Department of Commerce. AG Biome was founded in 2012 around a microbial discovery platform and technology with the goal of developing new crop protection products. The company in 2017 received approval from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for its first product, a fungicide called Howler. The agency approved AG Biome's second product, a fungicide called Thea, in 2022. To save cash, G1 execs slash pay by 10%. Executives at G1 Therapeutics are taking pay cuts as the public biopharmaceutical company tries to manage costs and extend its cash runway. G1 on March 21st entered employment agreements with each member of its executive team to temporarily reduce their base salaries by 10%. This reduction will remain in effect through March 31st of 2025 unless the board reinstates the previous salary sooner. The base salaries for CEO Jack Bailey, Chief Financial Officer John Umstead, and Chief Business Officer Mark Avigliano will be lowered to $744,097, $386,370, and $452,654, respectively, per a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. While the SEC filing specifically identifies these three positions, G1 spokesperson Will Roberts says the entire executive team is taking salary reductions. The company also implemented a small headcount reduction, he said. California firm buys PQS in Durham. A healthcare technology company in California has acquired a Durham firm focused on pharmacy management technology. Pharmacy Quality Solutions is joining Innovacer, in a transaction that combines the former's pharmacy network with the latter's connections to providers. Innovacer is a healthcare technology firm that works with hospitals and physicians and uses its AI-powered platform to unify patient data. The companies did not disclose financial details of the transaction. Todd Sega, CEO of PQS, says the transaction is a full equity sale involving the company's two previous shareholders. Want to enroll at Duke? It won't be easy. Duke University remains the most selective school among higher education in North Carolina. That's according to a new analysis by the Business Journals, which used U.S. Department of Education data to identify the most selective schools across the nation. The rankings were based on a weighted formula that took into account both acceptance rates and matriculation rates. Duke accepted about 6.35% of applicants in fiscal year 2023, in line with fiscal year 2022, but continues a decline in the university's acceptance rate, which was 13% in fiscal year 2014. This rate puts Duke within the top 10 universities with the lowest acceptance rates nationwide. That's a good segue into our cover story this week. Colleges watch as numbers dwindle. Elite colleges remain on solid ground, but other schools worry as the number of potential college applicants starts to drop across the country. Cover story written by Zach Ezone. After more than a century in downtown Raleigh, the future of St. Augustine's University is bleak. The school is fighting to maintain its accreditation, preserving its access to financial aid for students, after its accrediting agency voted in December to remove St. Augustine's from its membership. The vote followed years of challenges at the historically black university founded in 1867. St. Augustine's owes $8 million to the Internal Revenue Service and has failed to pay employees on time on multiple occasions in recent months. Unable to support students on campus, the school will switch to online learning April 1st. Various alumni groups have called for the university's Board of Trustees to resign as the dire situation worsens. But the challenges at St. Augustine's, while far more intense, are not unique, as universities throughout the U.S. feel tightening financial pressure as the number of college applicants drops. Faced with declining enrollments, UNC Greensboro recently slashed about 20 academic programs. Meanwhile, UNC Asheville is scrambling to close a $6 million budget deficit. There's a growing divide in higher education where flagship public schools and elite private universities continue to attract students as other institutions struggle. NC State University, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke University, for instance, have all seen their enrollment swell over the past 10 years. But other Triangle colleges, such as NC Central, William Peace, and Shaw Universities, have seen enrollment decline. Even East Carolina University, with its large fan base and affordable price, is seeing enrollment decline. University leaders have long been concerned about the so-called demographic or enrollment cliff, the projected decline in the number of high school graduates and traditional age college students. What makes this shift even more troubling for universities is that a smaller share of high school students are enrolling directly after graduating. Demographics are just a question of how many bodies are there, says David English, the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs for the University of North Carolina System. The demand question is, of what pool, how many of them are willing to pursue and pay for a four-year degree? And that one for me is even more troubling because in many ways it's much more pernicious. Declining enrollment can lead to layoffs, program cuts, and even university closures or mergers. Fitch Ratings in September projected that significant restructuring of operations is inevitable for some higher education institutions. You either have to grow your way out of operating challenges or shrink, says Fitch Ratings Senior Director Emily Woodwani. Although this demographic cliff will carry in different regions of the U.S., it has slowly become a national concern, says Robert Kelchin, an education professor at the University of Tennessee. There are parts of the country where the number of high school graduates has been declining for more than a decade, Kelchin says. Nationwide, we're right about at the peak of high school enrollment, so for colleges that focus on traditional age students, it's harder for them to draw in more students. Back in 2021, the U.S. had roughly 4.27 million 18-year-olds, according to the Census Bureau. That number is expected to increase to 4.47 million in 2026, before plunging to 3.82 million by 2039. North Carolina, with a growing population and booming economy, is not expected to see the same population declines as regions such as the Midwest or Northeast, but that does not make it immune from these demographic shifts. While urban areas such as the Triangle are growing, rural areas are not. Population projections from the NC Office of State Budget and Management expect the number of people between the ages of 18 to 24 years old in North Carolina to remain mostly flat in the coming decades after previous years of increases. The number of people in this range in the state in 2000 was estimated at about 808,457, which increased to 1.03 million by 2020. That number is projected to only grow to 1.08 million by 2040. We don't have an enrollment cliff as much as we have an enrollment plateau, says UNC's English. But that plateau is a huge change from the last 20 to 30 years of operation, where every year the pie got substantially bigger. Shrinking this pool even further is a declining trend in the share of high school graduates enrolling in higher education. After fluctuating between 40 to 42% for more than a decade, the college enrollment rate of people between the ages of 18 to 24 dipped to 38% in 2021, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Many prospective students believe college is too expensive and will lead to too much debt. Students also have concerns about the return on investment for a college degree. If I'm worried about cost and debt, and then I don't think that I'm going to get a solid benefit from it, then I'm more likely just to say I'm out, English says. The UNC system is trying to push back on this narrative. The General Assembly a few years ago required the system to evaluate the return on investment of universities and their programs. These ROI calculations were based on comparisons between the expected lifetime earnings of UNC system graduates against the earnings of those without a degree. Deloitte led the study, which presented to the Board of Governors in November. The study found that 93% of the 1,364 programs offered at universities had a positive return on investment for students. The median lifetime ROI for an undergraduate with a degree is nearly $500,000, according to the study. The study can help the system communicate with students about the programs that can benefit their lifetime earnings, English says. Additionally, the system can look closely at programs that did not compare as favorably to evaluate whether they are terminated or revised. Private universities as well are having to make similar decisions as they try to reach more students in an increasingly competitive landscape. Hope Williams, president of North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities, says universities have become even more responsive in tailoring their programs to fit student needs and interests. Our colleges always have to look at programs and evaluate what is working and what is not, and where the demand is and where the demand used to be, Williams says. Not all universities are feeling these challenges equally. Both UNC Chapel Hill and NC State have seen their enrollments increase over the past decade, with UNC Chapel Hill rising from 29,135 students in 2014 to 32,234 in 2023, and NC State rising from 33,989 to 37,323. But East Carolina has seen its enrollment drop from 27,511 to 26,785 during that time. And NC Central, which saw enrollment reach 8,207 in 2018, dropped to 7,965 in 2023. The divide is reflective of a change in what students are looking for in a university experience. There are more students looking for the traditional big campus experience, and they're going to these larger, better resource institutions, Kelchin says. And with a limited pool for high school graduates, if the flagships are taking more students, that means there are fewer students for everyone else. A similar divide is taking place among private universities, with brands like Duke University continuing to grow enrollment while others decline. Maintaining enrollment is vital to the financial health of universities, as tuition and fees are a significant source of revenue, says Larry Ladd, a senior consultant at AGB Consulting, a firm focused on higher education. Financial status is clearly connected to enrollment, Ladd says. You have to attract enough students to produce enough net tuition revenue. This reliance on enrollment is even more acutely felt by private universities that do not receive state funding. The UNC system, for instance, saw its revenue from in-state tuition increase only 2% between fiscal years 2018 to 2019 and 2022 to 2023. Meanwhile, the system's revenue from state appropriation grew by 20% during that time. The Board of Governors on February 29th approved tuition and fees for the 2024-2025 academic year, keeping the average annual undergraduate tuition for universities, excluding NC Promise institutions, at $4,533. NC Promise includes four universities that offer in-state tuition of $500 per semester. This marks the eighth year in a row the system has held tuition flat for in-state undergraduate students, although the board approved increases for out-of-state and graduate students at various universities. This is in line with what other universities, both public and private, are doing nationally as they try to keep prices lower to attract students. Potential students have an upper hand in where they choose to go, Ladd says, so in many cases colleges are lowering their price, offering more financial aid in order to attract students, but that hurts their revenue. The freeze on tuition prices at the UNC system can be difficult on campuses, says Wade Mackey, professor at UNC Greensboro and chair of the UNC Faculty Assembly. Much of the expenses at universities revolve around labor and facilities, the prices of which have increased over the years while a key source of revenue has remained unchanged. The good news is that North Carolina is one of the more affordable places for any in-state student to go, Mackey says, but that has created additional pressure on campuses because effectively we're not able to raise the price of the product to match the cost of providing that product. After slowing over the past decade, the trajectory of tuition price increases cratered during the pandemic, which is Wadwani says. This is easier for public institutions that receive state funding for operations and capital projects. And when these institutions keep tuition low to preserve affordability, it becomes more challenging for private institutions to push through tuition increases. From our perspective, the days where you can make your margin on tuition growth, that's really hard to do in this environment, Wadwani says. Universities typically have few options when dealing with these enrollment and financial challenges. They can push harder to attract recent high school graduates, boost their efforts to reach new student populations, or cut costs, Kelchin says. They have to really double down on recruitment and mission to try to get more students, Kelchin says. But otherwise, the alternative is to start thinking about, are there ways that we can make cuts to be able to support the number of students that we have? Amid the projected decline in traditional age college students, the UNC system is trying to attract adults interested in pursuing a degree. Lawmakers in 2021 allocated $97 million to Project Kitty Hawk to support online degree programs in an effort to reach more adult learners. The nonprofit recently last year launched its first online degree programs with NC Central and is launching programs with East Carolina. In addition to reaching adults, the UNC system needs to look at attracting students from outside of the state, according to a resolution proposed in March by the UNC Faculty Assembly. Large universities in other states, such as Alabama and Georgia, are similarly recruiting heavily in North Carolina. UNC system schools have out-of-state enrollment caps, with the amount varying between universities. UNC Chapel Hill and NC State are at 18%, while the caps for East Carolina and NC Central are 18% and 35%, respectively. But not all universities reach those thresholds. If they did, it would generate about $430 million cumulatively in tuition and fee revenues for the system, says Jim Westerman, a professor at the Department of Management at Appalachian State University. The Assembly's resolution calls on the Board of Governors and UNC system office to evaluate the system's missed opportunities for out-of-state students and launch a marketing program to boost efforts around this group of states. It seems like the system is focusing a lot on the cost side, but there isn't a lot of discussion about the revenue side and what might be able to be done there, Westerman says. One college that faced a similar crunch to St. Augustine's and survived is Bennett College in Greensboro. Bennett was on the verge of losing accreditation among financial challenges as the school's expenses became unsustainable. When President Suzanne Walsh joined the university in 2019, her first goal was to stabilize the school's finances. Rather than attempting to maintain a budget for 500 to 800 students, her goal was to put the university in a position where it could serve 200 students. The school, which remains accredited through a different agency, now operates as what she refers to as a micro college. I wanted to be absolutely realistic and ruthless about a number where we could stabilize and get ahead of our expenses, Walsh says. Since then, Bennett, a private, historically black college for women, has succeeded in stabilizing and improved its student retention rate to 90%. But the work is not done. Walsh says the university is now on a thoughtful path toward growth despite some of the existing headwinds. Our goal is to get to an enrollment that is at a minimum about 345 students, Walsh says. That would allow us to be in the black with a little bit more every year. William Peace University in Raleigh gets more than 70% of its revenue from tuition. The university has seen its enrollment decline over the past decade, according to data from the National Center for Education Statistics, but experienced an uptick to 730 in the fall. President Brian Ralph, who is leaving at the end of the semester, says the school's goal is to grow to 1,000 students, which would create more revenue for programs and services for students. The university has launched new marketing efforts to try to reach more students and added programs in popular academic areas like game design. William Peace has also added an online program through which registered nurses could earn a Bachelor of Science in Nursing as part of an effort to attract more adult students. In addition to tuition, endowment funds are critical to private colleges. William Peace received a boost to its endowment with the 2018 sale of Seaboard Station in downtown Raleigh. William Peace bought the property for $20.75 million in 2013 and sold it for $34 million in 2018. This helped grow the endowment to around $50 million, which William Peace uses to provide more scholarship support to students and can help the school's enrollment. In competing for students, Ralph says William Peace tries to keep tuition costs close to UNC's in-state prices through various grants and scholarships. And he's optimistic about the future, given North Carolina is not seeing as drastic population changes as other states. It's going to be a challenge for us, don't get me wrong, Ralph says, but I think we're positioned well to take advantage of it. The Editor's Notebook column is written weekly by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. A disturbing story came across my desk on March 25th. This is a New York Times story on Amira Yayaoui, a Tunisian human rights activist, and her student aid startup, MOS. That's M-O-S. As the Times looked deeper, the newspaper cited PitchBook data and reported Yayaoui raised $56 million from high-profile investors, including Sequoia Capital, John Doerr, and Steph Curry. MOS was valued at $400 million. But as the paper looked deeper into what Yayaoui told other media companies, such as TechCrunch, about having 100,000 bank accounts to help students with their financial aid, the Times research showed less than 10% of Moss's roughly 153,000 bank users had put their own money into their accounts. Yayaoui claimed that the company had helped more than 400,000 students get financial aid. I'm sure more will come out about Moss and Yayaoui's practices in the days ahead, but reading the story reminded me of another entrepreneur who stole the limelight of the business press and international media some 10 years ago, Theranos and its founder, Elizabeth Holmes. Holmes claimed that she had invented a process that could reap vast amounts of data from a few droplets of blood derived from the tip of a finger. Theranos was born, and the company eventually raised $400 million from venture capitalists. The post-raise valuation of Theranos climbed to more than $9 billion. Of course, now we know the tools and technology of Theranos did not work, and the investors were misled along the way. In 2018, a federal grand jury indicted Holmes and Chief Operating Officer Ramesh Balwani on fraud charges. Her trial in the case of U.S. v. Holmes et al. Ended in January 2022 when Holmes was convicted of defrauding investors and acquitted of defrauding patients. She started serving the 11-plus years of her jail sentence last year. Stories like these could have been avoided if the founders, CEOs, and leadership did not use hyperbole to describe their products and services. But they do, and many people trying to convince investors still do the same. That's a dangerous game to play. But beyond just hurting specific investors, these stories have a chilling effect on the investment ecosystem. Yayaoui and Holmes are not alone. Far from it. Somewhere in Raleigh, Durham, Boston, or Silicon Valley, it just happened while you read this. A company promoter making claims about a product or a service that is far from proven and could be seen as borderline information or untruth. But that is the line, isn't it? Company boards that hire CEOs and work with founders need to be held accountable for what they say to the public, media, and investors. Words from our leaders matter far more than most people can imagine. Is it possible that because of Holmes' actions, investors may be less willing to fund women-owned startups? Maybe. In general, however, women-owned startups received just 2.8% of all venture dollars in 2023. Beyond startups, CEOs of public companies such as Enron, WorldCom, Lehman Brothers, and many more lied to markets and the public to keep their companies afloat. In the end, reality set in. Executives went to jail. Investors lost billions, and hundreds of thousands of jobs were lost. It's all because of hyperbole. We have another opinion editorial this week from John Hood, who's a member of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Light touch can make homes affordable. Because North Carolina is one of the seven states likely to determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential election, and also boasts highly competitive contests for governor and other statewide offices, local races may not be top of mind for most voters. Nevertheless, North Carolinians will help elect hundreds of county and municipal officials this year, which essentially puts the issue of housing on the ballot. Unlike many other issues, housing policy doesn't generate predictably partisan debates. You'll find Democrats and Republicans who favor zoning reforms and other policies that facilitate higher density development. You'll also find Democrats and Republicans who oppose these reforms, expressing concerns about traffic, property values, and quality of life. On housing costs, North Carolina is doing better than most places. Last year, U.S. News ranked our state 17th in affordability, and recent upsurges in new construction have modestly reduced average rents. Chuck McShane, director of market analytics for the real estate research firm CoStar, reports that Charlotte's projected 13.2% increase in multifamily units this year will be the largest of all major markets, making up 29.3% of all new housing inventory. Raleigh is also near the top of the list, with multifamilies making up 12.5% of inventory. Nevertheless, for many new and not at all new North Carolinians, finding an affordable place to live remains a challenge. Local officials have a role to play in addressing it. They need to make it easier to build and sell a variety of housing options that will in turn require a realistic and persuasive strategy for engaging folks who view these options with skepticism. Tobias Peter, who co-directs the American Enterprise Institute's Housing Center, has spent years developing such a strategy. He calls it light touch density, defined as moderately greater density in areas zoned exclusively for single-family detached homes. Its policy applications depend on the particularities of a given market. In neighborhoods where prices are already high, for example, a reasonable LTD policy would be to allow property owners to replace a single unit with a complex of 2 to 8 units. In the medium-cost neighborhoods that constitute most of the housing stock in North Carolina's metropolitan areas, Peter recommends allowing property owners to add units to the existing home, whether they be attached or detached. Even such light touches have opponents, of course. Peter advises housing advocates to engage them, gain a better understanding of their concerns, and respond in ways that reflect that understanding. To left-leaning residents, emphasize how higher density infill will foster walkable communities and disrupt the vestiges of past discrimination. To right-leaning residents, emphasize LTD's respect for property rights and use of private rather than taxpayer dollars to ameliorate the housing crunch. The stakes couldn't be higher. University of Iowa professor Jerry Anthony has researched how the issue interacts with broader economic health. In a study of the country's 100 most populous metros, Anthony found that decreases in housing affordability had a statistically significant negative effect on economic growth. North Carolina needs to get this right, and North Carolina voters need to hear more about it during this year's elections. This week's executive voice is Christine McDonald. She's interviewed by Laura Brummett. Christine McDonald has spent decades molding and shaping design in Raleigh, leading marketing and design efforts for architecture firms and commercial real estate companies. Now, McDonald is taking on a new role as Chief Operating Officer of Loudoun Hospitality, where she plans to help make Raleigh a little more weird. The hotel development and management company is a new offshoot of commercial real estate firm Loudoun Properties, with Russ Jones at the helm as CEO. McDonald left her role as principal and director of marketing at Jay Davis to join Jones and his co-founder, Henry Ward, at the inception of Loudoun Properties in 2018. She helped develop the Longleaf Hotel in downtown Raleigh. Loden Hospitality manages 734 hotel rooms and plans to develop more properties. Why did you leave a secure position for a new firm? I've never been very good at following a chartered course or being cool with the status quo. I'm not a rule breaker per se, but I'm also not really a rule follower. I'm a curious person by nature, and I like to do things differently. And I thought, yeah, sure, this is great. Let's do it. We had no idea what we were really going to be doing, but I'm so glad I did. What led to establishing Loden Hospitality? As we started bringing on additional hotels, Russ and I recognized that we really loved the art of hospitality and the industry and the business of it. Management of hotels is a 24/7 endeavor, and delivering on hospitality and commercial real estate is very different. We were really passionate about it, and that's what we wanted to focus on. Are your hospitality properties successful? Absolutely. In addition to the Longleaf, we recently brought on a brand new property that we just finished and opened in October in Boone called Rhodes Motor Lodge and Canteen, which has a full restaurant and bar. We operate several other hotels in the area, including the Sheraton Imperial, the Hampton Inn Midtown, the Aloft in Durham, and then also Guest House Raleigh. How's the Longleaf doing? We opened 3 months before the pandemic, and that was, for everyone, a really difficult time. But we have come back, and we're cruising right along. Occupancy is great. It's exactly where we want it to be. The lounge is doing really, really well. It's becoming very established, and people know about us. We're an important part of the community, and that's what we've always hoped for. What other projects are you working on? Our next project is going to be with the City of Raleigh. It's a Moore Square project. About a year or so ago, we were awarded the opportunity to negotiate with the city on the purchase of land there. It's two pieces. Both of them are mixed use. One is called Moore Square South, and I'll be focused on that, and Loden Properties is focused on the other side. Moore Square South is going to be hospitality with co-working. It's an entrepreneur and innovation center that's going to have a lot of very local businesses as a part of it. I don't have all the details yet, but our vision is an independent boutique hotel. I believe we proposed about 160 rooms. We're going to bring in some interesting food and beverage outlets as well, and we're going to have podcast studio space. We're currently in negotiation with the city to acquire that land. What about financing? Have you run into issues securing funding? Sure, I think that's something that everyone is facing right now. That's not deterring you from adding more projects? No, we'll figure it out. Timing is everything. In 2022, a 40-story rezoning request was approved for the site of the Longleaf Hotel. Are there plans for development there? No, we never had any plans. I think it was just thinking super long-term. We do not want to redevelop the Longleaf. We're very proud of what it is. We think it's important, and it's not going anywhere. What advice would you give to others starting out on their career journey? When I thought about my career, I found that all the leaders I worked with saw me as a sounding board. I was a trusted advisor. My advice to others would be to be a good, active listener and stay true to yourself. Being trustworthy makes a huge difference. Take advantage of opportunities, and when you're asked, don't be afraid to offer your educated opinion. Do you have a favorite part about being COO? I love working with teams. I love getting lots of ideas and having people come up with solutions. Nothing is more interesting than getting very different views and coming to a solution. Do you have a favorite hotel property? Absolutely. The Hotel San Jose in Austin is my favorite. I've stayed there many times, and to me it's a wonderful example of mid-century modern. It was lovingly restored 25 years ago, and it was really at the beginning of this movement of the restoration of motels. They captured the spirit and essence of a place so well. I use it as a precedent. What's your favorite kind of design? I'm not interested in trying to recreate period pieces. It's about celebrating the history of a place and allowing that history to shine through, including any of the little blemishes that might exist. It's the imperfect that makes things interesting. In business news, Smoky Hollow and Seaboard add to their mix of retail tenants. A handful of retailers are coming to two mixed-use developments in downtown Raleigh. Just announced for Kane Realty's Smoky Hollow development are Jet Set Pilates, Tucker Street Diner, and a new neighborhood bar by the team behind Madre. Jet Set Pilates is an internationally known brand known for its elevated Pilates experience. Franchise owners Renee Aquilino and Katie Myers will oversee the studio and its signature 50-minute classes that are set to energizing curated playlists. Tucker Street Diner is slated to open in the mixed-use development adjacent to Glenwood South in the fall of this year. Led by Michelle and James Park, the eatery will feature classic American fare with a modern twist. The Parks are also the owners of the Shiny Diner in Raleigh and Peak City Diner in Apex. The neighborhood bar slated to debut at Smoky Hollow will be owned and operated by the team behind Madre, which opened in the development in July. The new bar, which has yet to be named, will feature craft cocktails, beer, wine, and snacks. "We're so excited to welcome these three new retailers to Smoky Hollow," says Stacy Busher, Managing Director of Operations for Kane Realty. "Merchandising mix is crucial in these areas, and this group fills the gaps we were seeing." Alaxia's Indian Bistro, Morella Gourmet Paletas, and Noir the Nail Bar also recently signed on as tenants at Smoky Hollow. Another downtown Raleigh mixed-use development only blocks away from Smoky Hollow is also attracting more tenants. Omakase by Kai, a fine dining omakase-style restaurant, and Palmberries, a North Carolina-based acai bowl concept, are both scheduled to be open later this year in the Seaboard Station development by Hoffman and Associates. Led by Chef James Chung, Omakase by Kai will be a nearly 3,000-square-foot location at the base of the forthcoming Hyatt House Hotel in Seaboard Station. The restaurant's omakase-style menu features chef and seasonal selections. Palmberries now has six locations in North Carolina, with the Seaboard Station location to be the first in the triangle. The big number this week, $2.15 million, the amount for which Six Degrees Investment Ventures, LLC of Raleigh, purchased a roughly 27-acre lot consisting of dozens of homes off Britton Loop in Harnett County earlier this month. And that just about wraps it up for our time this week. We have run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.